If these young kids in this community can get the world's attention, then I can do anything. And the least I can do is tell their story.
A local entertainment reporter embraces her new role covering the front lines of protests in Ferguson. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The long-awaited film about Edward Snowden shows him as we've never seen him before.
His skin is incredibly pale. It looks as if all the blood has been drained out of it. The bedspread is white. The pillows are white. The headboard is white. You have this sense that we're entering a realm of someone who's being prepared for sacrifice.
Also, the Supreme Court upholds the right to protest everywhere, but at the Supreme Court.
I got some messages on Twitter and elsewhere saying that this is a classic example of NIMBY, of not in my backyard.
It's all coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. More than 2 months after 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot by police officers in Ferguson, Missouri, protests continue to occupy its streets and that of nearby St. Louis. So far, in what's been dubbed Ferguson October, thousands of trade unionists marched, hundreds picketed Walmarts to mark the August shooting of another unarmed black man, and activists for issues ranging from better pay for fast food workers to the plight of the Palestinians took their stands in Ferguson. Scholar Cornel West was among dozens arrested on what's been called Moral Monday. He said that's why he came.
We're here because we love the young folk. We want them to know that there's some older generation, brothers and sisters of all colors, who are willing to put their bodies on the line so that justice can roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream.
As a grand jury continues to hear conflicting eyewitness accounts of the Brown shooting, Ferguson has become both a magnet and a metaphor.
What's happening in Ferguson is a grim reminder that we're not yet in a post-racial America.
Ferguson today is a metaphor for abandoned urban America.
Ferguson has made it crystal clear to the African-American community and others that we've got to go to the polls.
It's also exposed the racial divide that had slumbered beneath the surface in St. Louis, resulting in recent ugly clashes between black protesters and white baseball fans at a Cardinals game.
Baseball protesters!
Mr. Fresh Meat and I'm causing problems.
Wave it upside down while we're the ones who gave all y'all the protection.
Let's go!
For a decade, Kenya Vaughn has reported for the St. Louis American, an historic African-American newspaper. Since the protests began in August, the paper has ratcheted up from a weekly to an up-to-the-minute Ferguson news hub. And Vaughn, who usually writes light features, is now producing vivid coverage from the street, streets that she knows very, very well.
One municipality over from Ferguson is Jennings, and that's where my grandparents lived for 40 years, and that's where I currently live. And that's actually about a mile from Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
What they call the Ground Zero, the burned out Quick Trip, was where I got my gas every Monday and Thursday.
How have your ties to the place affected your reporting?
The struggle for me personally is to have a certain level of integrity and objectivity as I report, because I remember as a young person, we knew certain rules and certain things to do to make sure that we didn't rouse suspicion. Something as simple as don't look at the police car. Keep your hands on your whip. Make sure your plates are up to date. Turn your music down. I mean, you get a drill, like, especially when you first start driving. I've felt targeted. I mean, my family members, people in my neighborhood, we've all felt like we've been targeted in some capacity from law enforcement. I was an entertainment reporter mostly by trade. I mean, I did soft news and feel-good features like so-and-so is turning 108 years old, you know? So you go from that to seeing people getting tear gassed. You kind of become a frontline journalist. No one could have prepared for what happened. But it was just so empowering to see these young people stand up for something that they believed in and refuse to sit down. If these young kids in this community can get the world's attention, then the least I can do is tell their story.
So it became everybody's beat at the paper?
Everybody's beat.
After the protests in August, Ferguson, as I mentioned, quickly became shorthand for police brutality, urban poverty, racial inequality, a symbol for the rest of the world. But what does that mean to you?
These situations that have been thrust to the forefront because of Ferguson, we've been reporting for years and years and years. So it was affirmation for us as we tell these stories to say, okay, see, this is what we were talking about. But the thing is, the dysfunctional relationship between especially the Ferguson police and the Ferguson African-American community has spilled over into the African-American community and white community in Ferguson. The relationship, which was cordial, has deteriorated. White people are afraid that the black people are, their intention in protesting is to take over Ferguson and run them out, which is not the case. And then the black people feel like they're still not being heard because nothing has happened as far as due process and moving forward with the case.
So just to be clear, no arrests, no trial date set.
Well, the grand jury is meeting, but no one has any answers.
What's your principal aim in reporting this story?
I just want to show people what I see, that these young people are out there every night in the elements, committed to doing whatever they can and use what they have, which is basically their voices, to show people that they want justice for Michael Brown.
So when a reporter from out of town tries to report this story, what should they keep in mind?
They should keep in mind that there's the potential for someone to be condescending when speaking with someone that they've made assumptions about based on what they look like or where they live. Canfield Green is a low-income housing complex, and, well, you see the tattoos, you may see gold teeth, you may see multicolored hair, but these people are the ones who put this story on the forefront. They captured the world's attention, and I say they should approach them with that same grace, just like they would any other subject for a story.
Through your reporting, I met people who seemed to be the soul of the movement who I didn't know. Tell me about Percy Green.
Percy Green is an activist icon around St. Louis. He has been on the front line for my entire life. Even if it's by himself, if it's chaining himself to a building or whatever it takes to get people to say, this is unfair. And when I saw him at the protest and he had this big grin on his face, the look on his face was like, well done, babies, well done. I know he probably felt like, oh my gosh, all of that was not for naught.
So when you look at what's happening in the community, Ferguson can change.
If South Africa can liberate itself from apartheid, then Ferguson can liberate itself from the division and the racial tension if this becomes a platform for conversation, uncomfortable conversations, but moving out of that discomfort comes transformation.
It's been 60 days of daily protests. What's it going to take?
Well, what it will take is for the police department of Ferguson to say, okay, let's talk. There has been no transparency in the case of Michael Brown, and that's all everyone has asked for from day one.
And you think that the national press coverage can help?
Well, yeah, because it puts pressure on them. If somebody is saying, why aren't you telling us this? Why aren't you telling this? If I'm saying this at the St. Louis American, it's one thing. But if you have the Washington Post and the New York Times saying, why aren't you telling us what's going on? Then the message becomes impossible to ignore, even though they still have been doing it. But
so we're speaking on Thursday. What's your next story?
There's this woman, this elderly woman named Margaret Morrow, and she comes every night. I've seen her there for the better part of 2 months, and she's there to protest, but she's also there to kind of love up on the protesters to make sure that rage doesn't get the better of them. She hugs them when they get angry. She talks to the police. She almost like the Mother Teresa of Ferguson, if you will, like a matronly presence to keep people centered. That's the next Ferguson story I want to tell.
Kenya, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Kenya Vaughn is a reporter for the St. Louis American, an historic African-American newspaper in St. Louis.
The focus on Ferguson has put police departments in the region under intense media scrutiny, and no wonder. During confrontations following Michael Brown's death, the cops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters, arrested peaceful demonstrators, and journalists as well. Next Friday, the St. Louis County and Municipal Police Academy will offer a class called Officer-Involved Shooting, You Can Win with the Media. The instructor is Rick Rosenthal, a former broadcast journalist and president of RAR Communications. He says that good public relations begins with easing the traditional tension between police and the press.
I have done programs where I have brought law enforcement into the room with reporters. And it tends to be like a high school fortnightly with the boys on one side and the eighth grade girls on the other side. And we start off by talking at one another, and then we end up talking about one another. And by the end of the program, we start talking with one another. But I think that law enforcement in general terms doesn't fully understand mainstream media. And what you don't understand, you tend to fear. And what you tend to fear, you tend to try to crush.
What do they think about us?
One of the starting points for this Meet the Other Guy program is that I ask law enforcement and I ask reporters to describe the other guy. And so I get terms like hostile and aggressive and pushy. And it's each side describing the other.
The police response to the events in Ferguson was roundly criticized by, I think, just about everybody. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on that, but I will ask you what you're going to tell the officers who attend your seminar.
To deal with the media relations aspects of the situation, even as you begin the investigation, even as you deal with all of the other aspects of any such incident. I'm not saying that media relations is the primary and principal first focus, but it has to be a part of the process. The National Incident Management System, which the federal government brought to us a number of years ago now in the wake of 9/11, makes media relations and public information a cabinet-level function. And in my opinion, that is appropriate. To the extent that you have the knowledge, you've got to step up and provide factual information in a timely manner.
Because as a practical matter, if you don't, you lose control of the story and you let irresponsible players fill in the blanks in ways that can do a disservice to everybody.
Nature does abhor a vacuum, and in any information vacuum, social media will step in, and individual citizens with truly no knowledge of a situation will start voicing innuendo, hearsay, speculation, and rumor, and all of that takes on the aura of fact to the detriment of the individuals involved, the organization, the family. It doesn't help anybody. It hurts.
Now, obviously, police are reluctant to provide information that could compromise an investigation.
Yes.
But that has often been used as an excuse to stonewall altogether, especially if an officer has been involved in a shooting.
I think that law enforcement and the citizens in any individual community and the media in general, I would hope, would first and foremost be interested in justice. And that means that the sanctity of the investigation must be safeguarded. But by the same token, if there is an information vacuum, then we get back to social media filling in that vacuum. So my recommendation is middle ground. Please, law enforcement, tell us what you can. And without being specific about the details of the investigation, you can share with us the general process. What's it going to look like? My strong recommendation is that there be as much transparency as is possible, always consistent with law enforcement's other needs.
If we agree that public relations is really not the most important issue in the aftermath of a shooting death, is the very title of your seminar, You Can Win with the Media, something on the cynical side?
I don't want the law enforcement community to win at the expense of the media, nor do I want the media to take advantage of and abuse the law enforcement community. We both come out of this, media and law enforcement, getting a fair shake. If I can help law enforcement understand the mechanics of broadcast journalism and print journalism, of which I was a part for the better part of 30 years, then I think everybody's going to win.
Rick, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Former Chicago news anchor Rick Rosenthal is a media relations consultant and president of RAR Communications.
Coming up, more on protesting. The Supreme Court says you can do it just about anywhere, except the Supreme Court.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Americans have the First Amendment right to protest. In 2011, for instance, the Supreme Court upheld the right of Westboro Baptist Church picketers to spew hateful allegations at the funeral of a soldier killed in the line of duty in Iraq. And just this past June, the court struck down a Massachusetts law that created protest-free zones around abortion clinics. The court has often determined that free speech is sacrosanct, except, evidently, when it's in the justice's backyard. Late last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia heard the arguments of the Supreme Court marshal seeking to uphold a 1949 law that bars political protesters from the court's plaza. The marshal is appealing a lower court's decision to uphold the First Amendment right of a student arrested there for holding a sign protesting police brutality. At least one federal judge didn't buy the marshal's argument that the student's protest was political.
What he says is the U.S. government allows police to illegally murder and brutalize African Americans and Hispanic people. I don't see a political party there. I don't see an organization there. There may be a movement there.
Adam Liptak has recently written on the case for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back to OTM.
Good to be here.
What prompted this?
A couple of years ago, a Maryland student named Harold Hodge decided he wanted to stand on the plaza, the vast marble plaza with fountains and benches that 300,000 people a year visit, and wear a sign protesting police brutality. He was arrested. They dropped the charges in exchange for him agreeing not to come back for 6 months. But he did want to come back, so he sued and challenged this 1949 law and won in the district court. The district court said that this idea that this entire plaza in front of the Supreme Court is a free speech free zone violates the First Amendment. A Supreme Court official appealed, and just last month, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington heard arguments.
So after this lower court handed down its decision, the Supreme Court came right back and promulgated these regs, which seemed to double down on the 1949 law. Why?
Well, as a practical matter, once the law was struck down by the lower court, protests could have started the next day unless the court took further action. Now, there's been a separate lawsuit against the new regs, but the larger message here is that the court really does care that people not be protesting on the plaza. Some reasons for that come to mind, which might be security concerns. You want to make sure people can get in and out of the court. But those same concerns appeared outside of abortion clinics, and the court said address those problems specifically, but don't have a general all-purpose ban on speech. The court's main argument is twofold. One, that the protests would influence the justices. And that's a little hard for me to get. I don't think people with signs are going to change the course of American jurisprudence. And if they would, I don't know why the signs that people do carry every day on the sidewalk in front of the plaza wouldn't do the same thing. The court also says it fears that people would think the justices are susceptible to influence by outside forces if they allowed protests on the plaza. And I guess I'll let others evaluate that argument.
Now, what strikes me as being ironic about that, Adam, and maybe even a bit hypocritical, is that in its landmark Citizen United decision, this very court ruled that the public is perfectly capable of figuring out the political intentions of paid political advertising, no matter who the sponsors were. And yet, the court doesn't seem to trust the public to offer the same level of what you called skeptical discernment when it comes to the court viewing protests outside their chambers.
The classic theory of the First Amendment is that it's a marketplace of ideas where citizens in a democracy can be trusted to sort and sift and evaluate and make sense of the messages that they hear. And the best idea will win. And if that's good enough in the context of a barrage of political ads in election season calculated to mislead people, you would think it would be a good enough theory to support the idea that people could see protesters on the Supreme Court plaza without jumping to the conclusion that the justices will be influenced by those signs.
It just reminds me for all of the world of those folks who, let's say, vote for a bond issue improving the electrical grid, but then freak out when the high-tension line right-of-ways go through their backyard. Isn't what's good for the goose supposed to be good for the gander?
I got some messages on Twitter and elsewhere saying that this is a classic example of NIMBY, of not in my backyard. I think that a common sense understanding of free speech values would seem to indicate that this vast open plaza visited by so many people every year might be a place where they could exercise their constitutional rights in front of the building that houses the people charged with enforcing their constitutional rights.
Now, the Hodge case has been ruled on in federal court. Is it headed inevitably for the Supreme Court or that other case that you mentioned? And if one or both of them should arrive there, can the justices not but recuse themselves?
If the law is upheld by the lower courts, I think that's the end of it. If struck down, it probably does go to the Supreme Court, which will be like Christmas for people covering the Supreme Court. As for whether they have to recuse themselves, we have an example. There was a challenge to the constitutionality of the law in 1983, and the court sat and said they're going to split the baby, as it were. They're going to say protests are okay on sidewalks, but suggested that they were not okay on the plaza. So last time around, the justices didn't feel a need to recuse themselves.
It's probably worth observing that though in certain political matters we've come to expect 5-4 decisions in the favor of the conservative wing of the court, the conservative wing of the court has also been right at the heart of other free speech decisions. They've been rather purist about it. So if there is a political split within the court, my guess is it doesn't break down along the usual suspects.
The military protest case, I think it was 8-1 with Justice Alito dissenting. The abortion protest case, although the justices differed on the rationale, was unanimous. You know, this is a court that on some of these issues, some of these classic free speech issues, robustly and all but unanimously votes together. So I'm not sure this particular issue breaks down on ideology.
Which makes me ask you the question I wanted to ask you first, and that is, what? I just don't understand how this could be. Can you?
I have told you everything I know.
All right, Adam. Merry Christmas.
And to you, Bob.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times.
When NSA leaker Edward Snowden first emailed filmmaker Laura Poitras, he used the moniker Citizen 4.
In the end, if you publish the source material, I will likely be immediately implicated. I ask only that you ensure this information makes it home to the American public. Thank you, and be careful. Citizen 4.
That's Poitras reading his email in a new documentary which follows the unfolding drama of Snowden as he revealed his evidence of widespread NSA surveillance to Poitras and her reporting partner Glenn Greenwald in June of 2013. Since then, we've heard much from Greenwald, but little from Poitras. Her film, Citizen 4, opens in wide release next week. New Yorker staff writer George Packer recently wrote about Poitras and the making of Citizen 4. He'd met Poitras years earlier, but he wasn't sure he'd be welcomed to join her in Berlin as she finished the film.
She approached me in 2004 after reading a piece of mine from Iraq in The New Yorker and said it showed me something in the occupation that I really want to try to capture on film. So what advice do you have? And we sat over coffee and talked for a long time. And next thing I knew, she had produced the most magnificent film about the Iraq War, My Country, My Country. But really, we'd fallen out of touch after maybe 2010. And I actually had written something rather critical about Snowden and Glenn Greenwald in a British magazine, Prospect, earlier this year, which I know Poitras read. So I wondered if she would be open to me coming. And I have to say I was really impressed that she let someone into her inner circle at a very sensitive moment of filming who she knew had some political disagreements. So I went to Berlin really at an intense moment at the last minute before the film was to be finished.
So you call Citizen Four a political thriller in three acts.
Yeah, those are actually Poitras's terms of three acts. The first act sets up certain predecessors to Snowden, NSA whistleblowers like William Binney, Glenn Greenwald in Rio. We see him being interviewed by a radio station in the U.S. talking about Obama and surveillance and broken promises. We see Jacob Applebaum from WikiLeaks telling an Occupy Wall Street group about how the police will be on them for the rest of their lives. So it's kind of setting the context of what Poitras sees as, you know, dissidents being surveilled and persecuted for their political acts. And then from the very beginning of the film, she gets these emails from an anonymous stranger who goes by the handle Citizen Four. Act Two is all set in the hotel room in Hong Kong where Poitras, Greenwald, and another Guardian reporter spent 8 days with Snowden getting the leaks and hearing his story and his account of his own motives. And that part of the film, I think, is the heart of the film. It's quite claustrophobic. But what we see is a more human Snowden over the course of these days as the tension starts to break him down a little bit. And the third act is all the consequences of the leaks.
You mentioned that the heart of the film taking place in the Hong Kong hotel room was claustrophobic. And what you experienced as the film was being finished was also infected with that pervasive sense of paranoia. Jacob Applebaum, the hacktivist from WikiLeaks, only wanted you to talk to him in a sauna, naked.
He said he wanted to take a sauna, and that's where he wanted to be interviewed. But later it occurred to me that, clever, that was one way to be sure I didn't have a concealed surveillance device on me. Around Poitras's circle in Berlin, which is kind of a surveillance expat circle, and you're often being told, leave the phone out of the room, or why did you bring a phone, or please shut your phone off. Applebaum, you know, takes a different route home, tells a taxi to come three doors down and across the street. As an outsider, I felt to some extent I can understand it. It may be an atmosphere that was necessary for Poitras to both keep the secrets of Snowden and to finish her work on the film. But in that tight and rather claustrophobic circle, there isn't a sense of proportion.
You say that her decision to edit out key material to protect the second source that we don't know about gave the ending of the film a quality of irresolution and anticlimax.
Yeah, perhaps inevitably. I'm not questioning her judgment about what was a potential risk for the source. But the final result is an ending that feels as if the viewer is being shut out rather than enclosed in it. You have a scene where Snowden is receiving scribbled notes from Greenwald to elude any Russian audio surveillance in this hotel room. The camera sometimes shows what's written in the note, sometimes doesn't. What we get are Snowden's reactions, raised eyebrows, shake of the head, curses, says, I can't believe this. This is huge. This is dangerous. I hope this person knows what he's doing. This could raise whistleblowing to a whole new level. And we just don't know what it's all about. And in fact, the two or three bits of information we do get are actually quite old and familiar.
Scoops that aren't really scoops. President Obama signs off on certain drone targets. We all knew that. The one big scoop we're allowed to see that is supplied by this second source is information about a government watch list containing 1.2 million names. And it's a reference, I assume, to the Terrorist Identities Data Mart Environment, or TIDE, which is something that Greenwald wrote about in August. It's been reported that hundreds of thousands of names are being added each month or something like that, and that it's basically a combined database of the CIA, the DIA, the FBI, the NSA, and so on. The government itself has touted TIDE.
You know more about TIDE than I do, but she told me at one point the documents interested her less than Snowden himself. And that's a completely of a piece with Poitras's work as a filmmaker. She is interested in human situations. She follows the story where it leads her in Iraq, in Yemen. Her second film, The Oath, she allows circumstances and the messiness of human life to take over. And that's absolutely the case in those first two films. She told me she likes to watch people make real-life decisions, to be confronted with decisions so that you're seeing them having to figure it out, and they don't give you a narrative they've already prepared, which is what happens when you sit down to interview someone. She doesn't interview people. She watches them live. Snowden, it was an interview, and he had already carefully constructed a narrative of being a conscience-troubled government worker who felt that the public had a right to make its own mind up about these big intrusive programs. That may well be true, but it's seldom the whole truth that what someone says is their motive is their only motive, and it's the filmmaker's task to try to keep peeling back the layers. And what's more, for me at least, that kind of high-mindedness, although it's admirable, is not necessarily interesting. It's kind of an open and shut matter.
And yet her craft and her heart created an enormous bond of sympathy, I think, between even a skeptical audience and her principal character. And Poitras's editor told you that it was clear from the raw footage that here in Snowden was someone who had decided to sacrifice his life.
You're absolutely right that she brought Snowden to life in a way that he really had not brought himself to life. He appears in that hotel room in some scenes in a white T-shirt or a white bathrobe. His skin is incredibly pale. It looks as if all the blood has been drained out of it. The bedspread is white. The pillows are white. The headboard is white. You have this sense that we're entering a realm of someone is being prepared for sacrifice.
He almost reminded me of Murat Saad.
Or of, dare I say, the risen Christ. I mean, he says to him, Laura Poitras, in an early email, you will nail me to the cross. The interesting thing is Poitras has never seen all the footage. She couldn't really stand it. She'd let the editor, her editor, watch it. And the editor, Mathilde Bonnefoy, French-American editor, said to me that when she first saw it, she realized Snowden had already – he was like a suicide. He had already prepared for death. But at some point in that hotel room, he decided to live.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see him making that decision. When did he decide to live and why? I think because of her incredible identification with him, Poitras respects his privacy in a way that I'm not sure she would have in her earlier films with her earlier subjects.
In the aftermath, the third act, as it were, it could have shown many of Snowden's subsequent revelations had less to do with the potentially unconstitutional spying on civilians and more to do with legal intelligence operations abroad.
Right. And in fact, William Binney, who I think is one of Poitras's heroes, who's the original NSA whistleblower before Snowden, he told USA Today that he's a great supporter of Snowden's, but when he starts talking about hacking into China, he's actually leaving whistleblowing and moving toward treason. That's the word he used. That's something that Binney might have been asked about in that last act, but instead Binney is seen testifying against American surveillance in front of the German Bundestag. The answer, I think, is once we're out of the hotel room, Poitras is on a very powerful roll toward the conclusion. And I think Poitras is open about this. The film is not looking at both sides, is not trying to give equal time to the government position. It's not a frontline documentary in which we hear different voices expressing different points of view. It is a piece of activism as well as of artistry.
You wrote that for Poitras, what gave the story gravity was Snowden, but for you, it was Poitras herself.
Yeah, I mean, sitting with her in Berlin for many hours talking about the film and about her career, her work, as we were sitting there, her face began to appear to me like some Victorian artist. That sensitivity, that kind of dignity, and a sort of self-restraint that is no longer really part of the artistic profile, but is still very much part of Laura Poitras. And I saw that person being pulled into this world of Snowden and of secrets, WikiLeaks and of surveillance, I don't think that world is an altogether healthy world for an artist of great sensibility. And I didn't tell her this, but I'll tell you. I wanted to tell her, you know, don't do a follow-up, which she might well do because she has a lot more material. Make your next film about something really different because I don't want you to be lost in this world. I don't know. I almost wanted to reach out and pull her back.
George, thank you very much.
It's always fun.
George Packer is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He wrote about Laura Poitras and her new film about Edward Snowden, Citizen 4, in the October 20th issue of the magazine.
Coming up, Marshall McLuhan declared, "The medium is the message." But even he could not foresee the convulsive impact of the internet.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 50 years ago, Marshall McLuhan published Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man. In that book, McLuhan introduced the world to his famous maxim, "The medium is the message." Within a matter of months, recalled author and critic Lewis Lapham, the book acquired the standing of Holy Scripture and made McLuhan, quote, "the foremost oracle of the age." Assessing all media that came before television and predicting all that would come after, McLuhan argued that we shape our tools and thereafter our tools shape us. Someday, he saw, we would all think differently. WNYC's Sarah Fishko offers us a quick glimpse of the enigmatic ideas of the enigmatic man.
Marshall McLuhan's way of thinking took the culture by storm in the 1960s. Television had just become a fixture in American living rooms, and McLuhan analyzed TV with strange, forward-looking aphorisms, like "the medium is the message."
Mr. McLuhan, if you'll be good enough, let's start there with the heart of your doctrine itself. The now famous sentence, "the medium is the message."
The medium is a happening. It creates an environment.
He spoke about how TV unified and tribalized humans, creating a global village. He was a great formulator around 50 years ago.
But a medium is the message in the sense that it creates a totally new world and a totally new psychic outlook for populations.
Not that he owned a TV himself. McLuhan wasn't ranting about the content of I Love Lucy or the dangers of the Untouchables, but about how the medium itself was affecting society.
Media are like that. They just alter the total social temperature. Since TV, the whole American political temperature has cooled down, 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 until the political process is almost approaching rigor mortis.
In the 60s, kids on campuses who had grown up with TV were ready for it, says author and Vanderbilt University professor Cecilia Tichy.
We were transfixed. We were embracing his position, talking about it late night over red wine in cafes and our ratty little graduate student apartments.
A lot of people felt at the time that he understood the new world as nobody else understood it.
At the height of it all, author and critic Richard Castellanets interviewed McLuhan, who was in his 50s, a graying gentleman in a sport jacket.
I remember visiting his house, and he would lie on his living room couch, and there'd be a whole bunch of books stacked on the top of the couch. That was how he understood things, by reading books and by extending perceptions from the books he read.
How did a book-smart, avuncular Canadian professor tap into the zeitgeist of the American 1960s? McLuhan himself might have said it was his distance.
Canadians have a tremendous opportunity to observe what's really happening in the world. I think we're very lucky to be a backward country.
He was very Canadian. And one of his ideas was he thought he could see the U.S. better from Canada. He wasn't immersed in the New World, but he thought about it.
Back in the 1950s, Canada was basically just a refrigerator and a hardware shop for Great Britain. It really didn't have much of its own identity.
Douglas Copeland's book on McLuhan is entitled "You Know Nothing of My Work."
And with that disengagement or freedom came a sense of, like, what is this TV thing here? Let's try and figure out what it's all about.
Marshall McLuhan, born in 1911, was not only a Canadian, he was also a devout practicing Catholic. Not necessarily the predictable resume for a hip media guru. And there were other factors contributing to his high degree of remove, including what Copeland describes as an Asperger's-like tendency in McLuhan's family background.
he and his mother were both perfect mimics, and they had these amazing memories where they could read something once and then just repeat it for the rest of their life. And their brains were just wired very differently than most people's then and now. And so it's not surprising he went on to have a different life, a different way of thinking.
It's impossible to have a point of view in the electric age and have any meaning at all. You've got to be everywhere at once, whether you like it or not, and that is not a point of view.
One by one, as he emerged, McLuhan revealed fairly breathtaking, if borderline incomprehensible, formulations. Seeing how Joe McCarthy had been demolished in a televised hearing a few years before, McLuhan called McCarthy too hot for TV. Hitler, he concluded, would never have risen to power in the TV era, nor any similarly over-the-top personality or event, such as the first television war, for example.
Like the Vietnam War is a hot war, and it won't go on TV. It's the first war ever, a hot shooting war ever shown on a cool medium. The cool medium involves the whole audience so deeply they find war unbearable. Show the same war on movie, on press photography and so on, people won't feel too badly about it. But on TV, they really feel it. And so LBJ is making a great big mistake in trying to have a hot war on a cool medium.
It's hard to imagine now, but during the swinging 60s, there was no more visible public intellectual than Marshall McLuhan. Later, Woody Allen immortalized him in Annie Hall.
Now, Marshall McLuhan deals with it in terms of it being a high intensity, you understand, a hot medium.
It was the realization of a brainy dream. Show up the pretentious fool who thinks he understands McLuhan by producing McLuhan himself to take him down. And there was the guru in his trademark jacket and white shirt.
You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
The fact is, that was quite right. Many people did and still do know nothing of his work.
His books are really dense. They're opaque almost. It takes a half hour to read four pages, then you have to put it down and really think. He's not an easy read. He never was.
But he was tuned in, McLuhan. He was the first to use the word surfing for the way we move through media and information. And he even predicted some form of our life with computers. All this 40 years before the fact.
We are hurrying back and forth across town at morning and night to situations which we could quite easily encompass by closed circuit. Documents, contracts, data. All of these materials actually could be just as available on closed circuit at home.
You have to remember, says Cecilia Tichy, that in the early days of TV, in the 50s, people were terrified that television might replace the book.
Here came McLuhan 10 years later to say, in effect, get over it. We're in a new era. Let's embrace it. Let's acknowledge it. Let's explore its values, its traits.
And explore its values he most heatedly and coolly did among citizens of the global village.
I mean, we've all been on a plane, and the moment the wheels hit the ground, every single person on the plane reaches into their pocket for their BlackBerry or their iPhone or what have you, and they want that sort of sense of connection. And I think when he talks about the global village, what he's really talking about is that innate need for everyone to feel far more connected than they were back in 1962. And now with Facebook, et cetera, it seems like there's no limit to how connected we want to be with each other as a, you know, as a species.
Do those things connect us or separate us, welcome us or alienate us? Has Google made us dumber or smarter? Those are questions Marshall McLuhan would have loved. No doubt he'd have had emphatic answers for them all in crisp and complex and very McLuhan-esque formulations in 140 characters. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fischko.
When Sarah produced that piece in 2011, she left us with some intriguing questions, and so we called Nick Carr, whose latest book is called The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. Nick, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
In your previous book, The Shallows, you do argue that Google is making us stupid, right?
Or the internet in general, but yeah.
How so?
One of the things that happens when we go online, in addition to getting access to tons of information, is we get bombarded by little bits of information. We become distracted and interrupted from the deeper sources of conceptual thought and creative thought and so forth, which really requires us to screen out distractions and pay attention to one thing for some period of time. the technology kind of encourages us to be browsers and surfers rather than people who go deep.
Wouldn't McLuhan have said that TV makes us stupid? And Socrates thought that writing made us lazy and absent-minded. Is this just a scared reaction to a technology that our minds haven't become accustomed to dealing with yet?
McLuhan, in particular, emphasized that whenever we adopt a new informational or communication medium, we do change the way we think. And that's what he meant by the medium is the message.
He didn't think those ways were necessarily bad, though.
No. I kind of venerate the printed word. He had trouble with it. It was his classic idea of a hot medium that so dominates us that we lose our connections with each other and with the world.
How is text, in his view, hot?
A hot medium for McLuhan was one that totally engaged us. Text was his classic example. You know, you can't shift your focus away from the text and still keep reading. You tend to cut off your hearing, your other senses, because you're so focused on interpreting the words printed on the page. That's what he meant by hot. It's very dominating. We become more isolated and more individualistic because we're not participating with other things. We're totally involved with the medium. So he thought electronic media, computer media eventually, would kind of free us from the domination of the word.
Of course, people use their telephones much more for reading these days than they do for voice communication.
And I think that would have completely blown McLuhan's mind. he thought we were moving away from the world of text. The telephone was an early example of that. We were going back to communicating by voice as we used to in oral cultures. And yet, the telephone has gone from being a voice medium to largely a text medium. Completely the opposite, I think, of what McLuhan expected.
So the more thorough the engagement, the hotter the medium is. And he saw television as a cool medium because you weren't cut off from other people somehow when you were watching it.
Well, we have to think of what television was like back in 1964 when he wrote Understanding Media. The picture was terrible. The sound was pretty terrible. It was usually black and white. And so it didn't dominate you. A cool medium is one that's low definition in his terms. It doesn't give us a whole lot of information. Now, of course, television is high def. We have huge screens. We have great sound. So I think it's actually been transformed from a cool medium to what McLuhan defined as a hot medium.
What would he have said about radio?
He thought radio was a hot medium, that in order to make sense of radio, you had to listen very, very hard. Just as text dominates your eyes, radio dominates your ears and kind of doesn't let you do anything else.
McLuhan talked famously about the global village. What do you think he would have thought of today's social networking?
I think he would have had mixed feelings. And in fact, he had mixed feelings about the global village. On the good side, it makes us more social, more involved with other people. But on the bad side, he thought the global village was one that was tribalized. There's no privacy. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing, constantly on view, constantly being judged. You lose this privacy and this kind of sense of individual self. Again, another example of how things haven't played out the way he expected them to. If he saw a smartphone, for instance, he would think it was the hottest medium possible because you just have to look at how people use the smartphone. They're completely immersed, all this rich information coming from it in its text and its visual and its audio, and it dominates you. And so on the one hand, that seems to be a very isolating technology in his framework because you're alone with the medium. On the other hand, you know, a lot of what people are doing is communicating with other people, expressing themselves. So there's this tension. It's like our new devices, our smartphones and tablets and stuff, are hot medium doing cool jobs. It would have been interesting to hear what he had to say about that because I don't think it fits into his paradigm all that neatly.
Nick, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Nick Carr's latest book is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovich, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Kat Tier Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. This week, we bid a fond farewell to two producers, P.J. Vogt and Alex Goldman. They've been at the helm of our excellent spin-off podcast, TLDR, for the last year. And if you haven't heard it yet, shame on you. Don't worry, you'll hear them again. They're moving on to bright futures in the podcast realm. Thanks for everything, guys. We will really miss you. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.